Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today, as is not unusual. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Trudy Lieberman, who's been covering healthcare reform for the Columbia Journalism Review. She'll update us on what's been going on since Obamacare was signed into law almost 2 years ago. A lot, and a lot of it not so good. And then at the bottom of the hour, an update on the Greek economic crisis from our poor, overworked European correspondent, Yannis Varoufakis. Before all that, a few words in the news. I saw in the paper the other day that Obama plans to run for re-election on a Reaganish Morning in America strategy. For those too young or too forgetful to remember, the 1984 Reagan campaign played heavily off the recovery from the deep 1981-82 recession. Ad man and voiceover specialist Hal Reiney narrated a classic Reagan ad that showed people going to work, getting married, moving into new houses, all routine activities given a magic aura by Reiney and company because of the great renaissance engineered by the Gipper. The Dems, by contrast, were painted as the party of gloom, doom, and yesterday, a role they seemed pretty comfortable playing. Now Obama wants to don the mantle of rebirth while the Republicans natter on about how everything still sucks and is getting worse. So how do things compare, economically speaking? Advantage Reagan, I have to say. The most recent economic data is mostly for January, the 37th month of Obama's presidency. A few highlights. First, employment. Both presidents endured sharp hits to employment earlier in their time in office, although in Obama's case, those losses extended the losses incurred by his predecessor. Obama's hit was deeper than Reagan's, but the bottom came earlier in his term. Despite that, in Reagan's 37th month in office, employment was nonetheless 2% higher than it was at the time of his inauguration. For Obama, employment is 1% below where it was when he started. Unemployment. Unemployment peaked a half point higher and a year earlier for Reagan than it did for Obama. But unemployment was lower in Reagan's 37th month than it was in Obama's, 8.3 for Obama versus 8.0 for Reagan, and it was coming down faster, well over 2 percentage points in the year ending in Reagan's 37th month, versus not quite a point for Obama. And the unemployment rate for Obama is actually worse than it looks because so many people have given up the job search as hopeless and withdrawn from the labor force and so aren't counted as unemployed. The participation rate, the sum of those working and those looking for work, actually rose over the first 3 years of the Reagan term. It's actually down slightly in the first 3 years of Obama's term in office. Incomes. Incomes are doing much worse for Obama than they did for Reagan. After-tax inflation-adjusted income fell harder for Obama than it did for Reagan, and it has barely recovered. Average after-tax income is 0.4% below where it was when Obama came in, but at a comparable time for Reagan, it was up almost 8%. Approval. The contrasting economic records are visible in the Gallup approval ratings. At this point in his first term, Reagan's approval rating was 54%. Obama's was 45%, 9 points below Reagan's. Obama's come up some in recent weeks, but he's still well below Ronnie, and Ronnie was improving at a much faster pace. So it's not really morning again in America. Pre-dawn, maybe. Back after a musical break to discuss healthcare reform. Thank you. That was some of the second movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 32, his last, performed by András Schiff. We'll hear two more excerpts from that masterpiece later in the show. In his wonderful lectures on Beethoven's Piano Sonatas, which you can get on the Guardian's website, Schiff denounces those who say that that passage sounds like Beethoven doing ragtime, but you can understand the temptation. My first guest is Trudy Lieberman, a contributing editor at the Columbia Journalism Review. She's been covering healthcare reform for that magazine, as well as the media's coverage of the issue. After Obamacare, officially known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010, passed Congress in March of that year, much has been going on while not too many people have been watching. Well, the lobbyists have been watching, but not too many of the rest of us. And by the way, that name. There's not a lot of patient protection or affordable care in that act, as we're about to hear. Trudy Lieberman is much more measured than I would be in her evaluation, but that's why she's at the Columbia Journalism Review, and I'm not. A clarification. We talk some in this interview about Medicare Advantage, without really defining it. Medicare Advantage was introduced in 1997. It allows people to take their Medicare benefits via private insurance. Typically, these policies cover the things that Medicare does, and then some. The government subsidizes those additional bennies, though that subsidy will be phased out in the coming years under Obamacare. Okay, here's Trudy Lieberman. All right, welcome, Trudy. It seems that when health care reform passed, people stopped paying attention to it, but there's actually a lot of stuff going on below the surface. So how is the healthcare landscape being remade since this legislation passed?
Well, essentially, the insurance companies are moving ahead with their plans to create more policies with much more cost sharing than people have ever imagined. So what we've begun to see, and we're going to see more of it, are policies that require people to spend a whole lot of money out of pocket. And by that, I mean that these policies will be calling for 20% coinsurance, but that's low in today's world, probably more like 40%, sometimes 50% coinsurance if people go out of network. And I think it's worth remembering that what coinsurance is, because people often have a hard time understanding it. It's the amount that you pay out of your pocket. And so that if you see your policy calls for a 40% coinsurance amount, you may be stuck with 40% of a very high bill if you're very sick. So people need to understand that much more of the cost is being shifted to them. And the reason for that is that the conventional wisdom right now in American healthcare is that we can control costs by encouraging or forcing people to pay or to go to the doctor less, and by penalizing them if they do go more. And so that's the idea behind the coinsurance and the increasing amounts of out-of-pocket that people will have to pay. So that is going on, and that may or may not be a good change depending on where you sit. I think the insurance companies and perhaps others in the healthcare system, it's a good thing, but to consumers it may not be.
Are there any kind of caps on copays in the legislation, or the insurance companies have their way?
There are out-of-pocket limits, and these have already begun to kick in, and most insurance companies do have out-of-pocket limits on their policies, but sometimes they can be very onerous. And I think people need to be careful about such limits because they may or may not be helpful to you in the end. So that when you're buying a policy with, say, low out-of-pocket limits or high out-of-pocket limits so that you don't have to pay quite as much, you will basically, there might be a trade-off in the policy. These policies are very complicated. And so that a policy may limit the benefits in some way in exchange for some other favorable provision.
Now, I wasn't clear on that, whether you said this is 40% for out-of-pocket, out-of-network, or actually in
within the network.
It could be either. It could be either. That's part of the problem. The shopping experience is getting very complicated because the companies are designing many different variations so that there are, like, many flavors of ice cream, and you have to pick one.
And there's supposed to be state insurance exchanges, right, where you do this comparison shopping. How's that working out?
Well, they haven't gotten into effect yet, and they won't until 2014. And many states have said they won't even develop these exchanges. They will wait and have the federal government take it over for them. What these exchanges will be is a large shopping service in which people, not everybody, can shop there. There are limits on who can shop there, and I think that's not well known. if you have insurance through an employer and you pay a certain amount and the employer pays certain amounts, there are income guidelines here, you will not be able to shop in the exchanges. You may be stuck with your employer's plan, even though it may not be what you want. Maybe it's too expensive or maybe it's a crappy plan. But people who do not have any other source of insurance will be able to shop in the exchanges. And what these exchanges do is set up a mechanism for insurance companies to offer their policies and consumers to buy their policies. And there will be some restrictions, some regulations governing the offering of those policies. And that is being decided right now in the state legislatures and in the exchanges, the people setting up the exchanges. And how those limits are set will determine really how easy and how useful the exchanges will be.
Are there some kind of regulations that are supposed to make these markets transparent, or are the companies going to be able to game that?
Well, this is the deal on transparency. A couple of weeks ago, the administration came out with its final rules on disclosure and the parts of a policy that had to be disclosed to consumers. And some of that disclosure is okay. It defines the terms pretty simply. It tells you what your limits are, what you might pay. For example, it lists the out-of-pocket limit. It talks about the amount of the deductible, what services are not applied to the deductible, what the amount of the coinsurance is, what the amount of the copayment is, and those are two very different things. But what it doesn't do is tell you the price. And I have written about this now extensively, that the disclosure forms do not require insurance companies to tell you the premium. And they did this because the industry, not only the insurers, but the employers, these disclosures also apply in the employer market, which is where most people get their coverage. So they don't have to disclose the premium either. So what that means for consumers is that they're going to have a whole lot more work to find out whether they want to buy a certain policy or not. And most people hate shopping for health insurance. They would rather go to the dentist, I think, than shop for health insurance. So what this omission does is just make the process more complicated, and consumers will have to make more telephone calls to find out what the premium really is, and then sit down and try to compare prices and other features of a policy. So I would say that that's not a very consumer-friendly development in health insurance right now.
It would seem the price tag is about the most essential feature once you've seen all the features. So how did this happen?
Insurance companies and employers did not want to disclose the premium for obvious reasons, because if you found a policy that had a low price and other features were favorable or ones that you wanted, you might buy that. But another company might charge you six times more for the same kind of policy with the same features, and it would not be helpful to that company for consumers to know that they were charging more.
And these schemes, they will all be sold within one state, or can you shop across state lines?
No, they're all state by state.
And there was some talk of some states experimenting with a single-payer arrangement. I believe Vermont was thinking of that. What's happening with that, if anything?
Well, the last I heard that the legislature had set up some sort of a framework for trying to achieve single-payer, or I guess in that case the state would be the payer. But the insurance industry and others who don't want it have been lobbying very hard, and I think it's really sort of up in the air exactly what's going to happen with that attempt. And the law right now bars states from experimenting, really, I think until 2017. It's way out in the future in terms of states being able to kind of come up with their own way of doing things. So that's not very helpful if a state wants to kind of go off in its own direction. But it's not only the insurance companies that don't want this, and I think this is often misunderstood. We've tended to demonize insurance companies throughout the whole health reform debate, because people generally don't like insurance companies, and it's very easy to sort of cast them as the villains. But I think, it's really important to remember that there are other villains in this whole drama, and that includes the whole medical profession and the doctors and the hospitals and the drug companies as well.
You said earlier that the copay, there's a philosophy behind it, which is that it's supposed to make people think twice about using health services that by charging something they won't overuse. And there's a theory also that the reason American healthcare costs are so high is because we overuse so many services. But data from the OECD and others show that's just not true, right?
That's correct. The theory behind high deductibles, high co-insurance, and high co-payments is that if you make them high enough, people will think twice or maybe three times before going to the doctor. However, the OECD study that you cite, I think, is very compelling. And what that showed is that countries, other countries that have national health insurance systems, use about the same amount of services we do. And in some countries, they use even more. Japan, for example, is a very high user of services. What that really is suggesting, and I think this is really the elephant in the room that nobody wants to wrestle, is that it's the price of the services we pay. It's the price level that is making our healthcare the costliest on earth. And I think the reason for that is that the doctors, hospitals, and the drug companies have historically wanted to make as much money as they can, and they still want to do that. And that's still the reason why the U.S. has never been able to enact a national health insurance system. And so I think it's wise to remember that the OECD study has a very important lesson for us and really raises the question about whether or not we're moving in the wrong direction by trying to reduce utilization and all these unnecessary services. And yes, there are unnecessary services, and there's a whole lot of overtreatment in the system, but they exist side by side a whole lot of underuse of services as well. But that underuse issue is kind of taking a back seat right now.
I'm speaking with Trudy Lieberman, who, among other things, has been covering healthcare reform for the Columbia Journalism Review, and covering the media's coverage of it. Speaking of healthcare care costs, you wrote recently about how hospitals are merging. What's that going to do to costs?
Probably makes them go up. And I think that this is one of the things that people need to think about, is we see these health insurance systems, these health systems in localities all across the country are getting bigger and bigger. And I think some of the biggest ones of all are questioning whether they're big enough, which suggests that there's a whole lot more consolidation to happen. So when the hospitals in an area consolidate, they tend to bargain together, of course, because now they're one system. And then they push back against the insurance companies, and they push back against the doctor groups. So many of these hospital systems are now being swallowing up the doctor groups to get them part of their system, to get them to behave within their system, which leaves them to negotiate with insurance companies that are also consolidating. So you have these oligopolies forming all over the country, and oligopolies are the antithesis of competition. And so this notion that was perpetuated during healthcare reform, that this law is going to make things more competitive, is just not the case.
And what, if any, cost control mechanisms are in the so-called Affordable Care Act?
Well, there are a few of them that people are sort of pinning their hopes on. One is called bundled payments, which means that the Medicare program, and perhaps spreading to the commercial insurers, would give doctors and other practitioners one payment to take care of all the services that a patient needs. And this is very reminiscent of managed care in the early 90s when managed care came about. This was the same argument that was given for managed care. There are perhaps some differences now between this newer version of paying one payment, but many people still are very doubtful that that's going to work, and I think it's worth thinking about a RAND study report that came out fairly recently that showed that there are a lot of questions about these bundled payments, and it may take years before them to really shake out to see whether they're going to control costs. And the other option on the table is the Accountable Care Organization. And these ACOs are supposed to be a way to provide seamless, simple care, so that it would reduce the fragmentation that we have in our system and make it easier for people to navigate and perhaps even provide better quality care. And I think the jury is really clearly still out on whether that's going to happen. And I think there was a story, I don't know if you saw it, Doug, but in the National Journal a couple of weeks ago that really investigated whether ACOs were going to turn the corner of our health care inflation. And I think it concluded that they probably would not because of all this consolidation that's going on.
And turning elsewhere in the system, we're now in campaign season, and controlling the costs of Medicare is sort of out there, but not being discussed very honestly. What's up with Medicare and the campaign around it? Are people being straightforward about what's happening?
Not particularly. I think neither side is being very forthcoming about what's happening with Medicare and how to control the cost of the Medicare program. I think what's on the table, and I think that this is what people ought to understand, that there is a real move afoot to change Medicare from a social insurance program into more of a welfare program. And while this may not happen this particular year, it probably won't happen because it's too politically charged, I think in a new administration, or even if it's still the Obama administration, this will be on the table next year. In such a system, people would be given, seniors would be given a set amount of money to buy a private policy in the private market. The amount of the voucher would be set by the federal government and would not necessarily increase over time within healthcare inflation. So what would happen over time is that the amount of the voucher would shrink relative to the cost of care and the cost of insurance, which means that people would have to pay a lot more out of pocket for their care, which, of course, would make it more difficult for seniors, many of whom are on fixed incomes, to afford their health care.
People say, I've heard it said that Obama is moving towards means-testing Medicare. A lot of partisan Democrats will deny that. Is there any truth to that?
I think there probably is. I think that there have been some talk by various administration officials about a possible change in Medicare down the road, and I think that talk kind of stopped as we got closer to the campaign season, because, of course, that would be anathema to a Democratic administration. But the Republicans are talking about it. Certainly that's the plan of Mitt Romney. That's the plan of Santorum. And I think that the Republicans and Paul Ryan, the Wisconsin representative who has talked about it pretty openly over the last year or so, that I think that's very much on the table. And as I said, I don't think anything will happen this year. But as we go into, say, the next administration, I think it is very much a live issue.
And also, it's true that Obamacare puts the squeeze on Medicare in order to pay for the presently uninsured, doesn't it?
Correct. What it did was, what the Affordable Care Act did was cut $500 billion from Medicare. So when the Republicans say that the Democrats cut Medicare, it's true that they did. However, that's really only a half-truth, because the cuts came from reimbursements to hospitals and to sellers of Medicare Advantage plans. The cuts did not affect any of the basic benefits for any Medicare beneficiary, and that part gets left out in all of the campaigning. But what happened was that the Obama administration and other supporters of Medicare, of the Affordable Care Act, needed to have money to pay for the subsidies for the uninsured, and they made a deal with hospitals to take most of it out of their reimbursements.
And what about that Medicare Advantage scheme? How's that working?
Well, so far, there hasn't been a whole lot of change, but most of the actuaries, the people who actually craft the insurance policies for companies, say that in the next 4 or 5 years, there's going to be a big shakeout when those cuts really begin to take effect. So far, they really haven't taken effect. And so it's been easy for the administration to say, see, nothing really's happened with Medicare Advantage plans. But we don't have enough time has not elapsed yet. So what will happen is that there will be changes in Medicare Advantage plans. And premiums could rise, the services they provide, all these extra goodies and so forth, will reduce, and people will not have the same Medicare Advantage plans they have today.
I think Mitt Romney would not like to talk about it, but obviously his health care scheme in Massachusetts has a lot in common with the national health scheme. What can we tell about what's going to happen on a nationwide basis from what's been happening in Massachusetts?
Well, there's a couple things happening in Massachusetts. One, there's been a statistic tossed around about how many people are uninsured, and you often hear it said that there are only 2% uninsured in Massachusetts, and the census, last census numbers showed that it was more like 5% who were uninsured, that the 2% number came from a study that has since been taken down from the website of the organization that sponsored it. The other thing that's happening in Massachusetts is that there are not any cost controls, and the law didn't intend to do any cost controls. So the big players up there are experimenting, or at least talking about, bundled payments and different kinds of payment models and so forth. But I think it's way too early to say whether any of that's going to really reduce the cost of care in the Bay State. The other thing that's happening is that there is an insurance exchange that they're called the Connector. And because of the new design and insurance policies, many people are having trouble sort of figuring out how to buy a policy. And there was a fairly good story in WBUR in mid-January that talked about the difficulty people were having kind of sorting through many different options. As insurance companies begin to tier their networks and giving the choice to consumers up there whether they want to pay more and go to one of the fancy hospitals or pay less and go to a local hospital, families are having a hard time kind of deciphering that all. So that gets back to the whole shopping question that is not going to get easier.
And they also have some fairly high copays in Massachusetts, don't they?
They're high deductible plans, absolutely. I can't remember the number. I think it's $2,000, $4,000. I'm getting mixed up with the Affordable Care Act, but they're pretty high. They're high deductible plans, no question about it.
So just in sum, it looks like we're going to have a confusing system that will be more expensive for most people and will do nothing really to rein in medical care inflation over the longer term.
I think that's a pretty fair assessment. On the positive side, there will be some people who will get help buying health insurance. There is no question about that. The question I have is whether or not those subsidies will be adequate over time.
I was Trudy Lieberman, a contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, who's been covering healthcare reform for that magazine, along with the media's coverage of the issue. You can find her work in the review's website, cjr.org, cjr.org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back to talk Greece after a musical break. Some more of the second movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 32, his last, performed by Andras Schiff. We'll hear one more excerpt from that movement, one of the glories of human life, at the end of this show. My next guest is Yannis Varoufakis. We've been working Yannis pretty hard here on Behind the News, but aside from being a good economist, he's Greek, and his country has been in the news a bit lately. Yannis is a professor of economics at the University of Athens, and I caught up with him in Adelaide, Australia, where he was for a conference. Before we hear the interview, a couple of clarifications. Yannis and I discuss credit default swaps, or CDSs. These are essentially insurance policies that investors can buy that pay off should the issuer of a security default on the obligation. Though intended to offer investors protection, they can also be used as speculative instruments in the sense that you don't have to hold the bond that's being insured. So if you think Greece might default, you could have bought credit default swaps on Greece and hope to make money on others' distress. The official arbiter of whether a so-called credit event, a lovely euphemism for default, isn't it, has occurred is the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, a trade organization consisting of bankers and hedge funds. Meeting on Thursday, under enormous political pressure, the ISDA decided that a credit event had not occurred in Greece, even though to the naked eye it looked like one had, just as Yanis Varoufakis had predicted. This is far from the last word, however. It's highly likely that hedge funds have bought CDSs in the hope of making money off a Greek default, and they may not go so gentle into that not-so-good night. Okay, here's Yanis Varoufakis. Welcome, Yanis. So, first of all, just give us the outlines of this Greek debt deal. Who's getting a haircut and how much hair is getting cut?
Well, officially, the private bondholders, the holders of Greek government bonds, come up to a sum of a little bit over 200 billion euros. They are going to take a hit of 53% of face value, and which of course means that given that the interest rates that will be prescribed for the new bonds that will be issued for less than half the value of those bonds, given that those interest rates are going to be quite low in net present value terms, supposedly in a manner in which we can compute these things, precisely, they will effectively lose about 70 to 80% of the value of their investment in Greek government debt. The idea is that they will, for every 100 euros that they are owed by the Greek state, they will get something like 15 back in cash, and they will get another 30 or so in new bonds that the Greek state is going to issue, and which will be which will have a very long maturity of about 30 years and a low interest rate. So this is the nature of the haircut. But of course, the question is, who is really hit by all that? A very large percentage of this 207 billion euros is owned by banks, Greek banks, German banks, French banks. They are the ones who are quite keen to see this deal go through. And that is why they are quite keen to have their investments cut so savagely, is because there is something else happening in the background which is of the utmost importance, and that is the European Central Bank is printing money like crazy, effectively giving it away to those banks, partly in return for their acquiescence to this debt swap with the Greek government.
According to the projections, the Greek debt ratio, debt-GDP ratio, will gradually go down to what are supposed to be sustainable levels over quite a long period of time. How reasonable are these projections?
Everything is unreasonable about this exercise, and let me tell you why. Firstly, if you read the official documents, as you put it, the idea is that the Greek debt-to-GDP ratio will shrink from the current 160% to something more sustainable like 120%. But if you work out exactly why did they choose 120% as a target, the answer, of course, reveals the hypocrisy of the whole thing. The answer has to do with Italy, because Italy's debt is about 120%. So if they were going to say that Greece cannot survive in the long term with a debt-to-GDP ratio of, let's say, more than 100%, then the question would be, so if Greece can't, why can Italy? So they said, okay, well, we will aim at Italy's debt-to-GDP ratio so as not to create an image problem for Italy.
But the Italian debt is owed mostly to Italians, whereas Greek debt is mostly owed abroad.
That's right. That's right. But you know, they understand that numbers can have a psychological impact. So they didn't want to set a target for Greece, which would be significantly below that which Italy will be characterized by. But okay, let's answer the question. All right. So how likely is it that the debt-to-GDP ratio of the Greek state will go down from 160 to 120? Well, you don't have to take my views on this. You have to simply look at what the International Monetary Fund is predicting in its own report on Greece's debt sustainability. The IMF, let's not forget, is party to this deal because it is part of the Troika, part of the lenders, the official lenders of the Greek state, and they take a very active role in designing this adjustment program. So they themselves say that to achieve this objective, the Greek economy should be growing within 2012 by something like 1.7 to 2%. and the PSI, this haircut, should be completely and utterly successful, in the sense that there shouldn't be any holdouts. Everybody owning Greek bonds should accept this swap. And moreover, and that is a huge assumption, huge assumption, that the massive reduction in government expenditure, which is going on as we speak, something in the region of 3 billion, additional 3 billion euros, a cut lobbed from Greece's government expenditure, in order to secure this loan, is not going to have this huge reduction in government spending, is not going to have a recessionary effect on the Greek economy. Now, if you look at the facts of on the ground, whereas this plan, as I said, envisages that the Greek economy ought to be growing within this current year at 2%, 1.7, 2%, at the moment we're growing at minus 7%. So we have an incredible shrinkage, one of the worst recessions in human history. And in this context, the assumption that the reduction of government expenditure by a further 3 billion is going to have no recessionary impact, well, this is pie in the sky. It's a science fiction scenario. And the IMF has effectively said so. And this is why they leaked their own sustainability analysis in order to effectively have an excuse in the future, in the near future, when this whole thing, this whole program, adjustment program, is proven to be utterly nonsense, so that they have to something to fall back on and say, well, we had warned you about this.
Now, also, this is supposed to all happen without Greece officially entering default.
Well, you know, one of the great productive processes in Europe over the last year and a half has been that which generates euphemisms. We haven't generated much sense and good policy, but we've generated amazing euphemisms. The one about Greece now not being in default, but being in selective default temporarily, not calling a haircut, but calling it a PSI, a private sector involvement. This is what has typified the current state of affairs. Greece has defaulted. Greece has gone bankrupt. People who invested in Greek government debt have lost more than 70% of their investment. Now, however we may choose to call this, it is a bankruptcy.
And not to get too technical for radio, but credit default swaps. I'm sure a lot of hedge funds and people have bought credit default swaps on Greece. Are they going to pay off, or how's this going to work out? There's surely a lot of interested parties who would like to see Greece enter formal default.
This is a very interesting question. In the next few days, the ISDA, which is the committee, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, they are the ones who get together. They are a consortium of bankers and hedge fund representatives who decide when a country is officially, or an organization is officially, in default in order to trigger the insurance contracts called the CDSs, the insurance contracts that people have bought in order to get a certain sum of money paid to them in case some organization specified in these contracts or state is declared bankrupt or is declared in default. I have no doubt that this time around, in the next few days, the ISDA, because it is completely and utterly in the pocket of the European Central Bank, the IMF, and the powers that be, for reasons that we can talk if you want, are going to declare that this is not in default. And therefore, this is not going to trigger the CDSs anytime soon. But sometime in March, when the Greek government bonds, on the 20th of March in particular, when that date comes and that repayment is not made in full, then the ISDA will have to convene again. And I'm sure that they will have to deal with requests from hedge funds that have purchased a large number of these Greek government bonds, and these hedge funds will demand that the CDSs are triggered because they've also bought CDSs at the same time. But the interesting question is, what does this all mean? And I think we're going to find out if the CDS trigger in March, late March, we may find out that there's going to be quite a bit of instability in the financial markets internationally. Not so much because those CDSs are huge. They are something between $5 and $10 billion dollars at stake. But I very much fear that some of our great and good and idiotic banks in Europe in particular have synthesized those CDSs with other parts of debt, including their own bonds. And these are pyramids of unknown size, which may topple, and then we will see what happens. But this is why the European Union is so keen not to have the CDSs trigger, and they will lean very heavily on the ISDA to declare that this is not, that this is a private swap, and therefore there's no reason to declare Greek officially bankrupt.
So this is essentially the mortgage securities that all the toxic derivatives that were built out of them revisited.
Indeed, indeed. Just like when the CDOs issued by Lehman Brothers and J.P. Morgan went belly up in the fall of 2008, there was the instant contagion that was caused by the fact that people who had bought insurance of these CDOs, the so-called CDSs, issued by the American Insurance Group, that caused the bankruptcy of the American Insurance Group, which, of course, played a very significant role in the whole house of cards coming tumbling down.
I'm Sukath Yannis Varoufakis, professor of economics at the University of Athens. And, of course, now from the arcane financial level down to the ground, what is happening to the people of Greece? You already said this is one of the worst recessions in human history. What does that mean to people in their lives?
The Greek social economy is being pulped down into the ground. It is astonishing. We've talked about this, you and I, before, when I was telling you that we could see on the street evidence of shops shutting down. Now this has turned into an epidemic. I mean, wherever you go, the few shops that are left open are empty of customers. It is impossible to hold a conversation in Greece now with anyone without going straight into a lament about the state of play. The credit chain has broken down completely. Let me just give you a personal example, not because my personal experience is more important, but it's just that it's more direct and I can speak to it with greater authority. Last June, I published a Greek book in Greek by a fairly good publisher, and turned out to be the hit of the summer. So I got a bestseller. I'm not going to get a penny out of it, and let me tell you why. Because the chain of credit amongst bookshops and publishers has completely and utterly broken down. Bookshops are in arrears to the banks, to their landlords, to the publishers. So whatever money they take in from the public is not sufficient to repay their publishers. The publishers, who have been accepting for years now post-dated checks, find that the checks that they have are bouncing one after the other. So the publishers are forced into an awful dilemma, either to shut down or not to provide books to bookshops unless they get cash in return, but then the bookshops don't have cash to give them, or to carry on producing the books, giving them to the bookshops free on credit, hoping that at some point they will get a percentage of what they are owed back from those bookshops, because they know that if they cut the bookshops off, the bookshops will effectively close down, and then the publishers will not get a penny from them. Now, this is simply one example of what typifies the Greek social economy. Everywhere, whether they are pharmacies, clothes stores, electrical and electronic suppliers and shops, they face exactly the same situation. On top of that, I was talking to an industrialist who's actually doing fairly well, simply because his factory is producing goods that are exported. So he has a pretty good export market. And this is amazing. This is, you know, good news, isn't it? It's where you would expect growth to come from, especially during a recession, from exports. Now, he's having a hugely difficult time, because even though demand is brisk and his company is very profitable, given that export market that he has secured for himself, in order to produce the goods that he's exporting, he needs to make to import certain raw materials. He's got the money, but when he goes to his bank to get a promissory note with which he will secure the imports from abroad that are necessary as raw materials for the production of the goods that he will then export. The foreign banks, the bankers of the raw material producers, do not accept the promissory notes from my friends, the industrialist Greek bank, because they don't trust Greek banks. So it is impossible for him to import the raw materials that are essential to produce the goods that have already been pre-sold to the export market. Now, this is a failed state. It's a failed social economy. And the more we are cutting deeply into the muscle of that economy with wage cuts, with reductions in pensions, and with bailout loans, which effectively push Greece further into default and bankruptcy territory without acknowledging that this is what they're doing and without having the cleansing effect of a proper default, the more comatose the Greek social economy becomes.
And yet this is the economy that's supposed to turn around within a year and start growing again.
Well, within 6 months.
That's insane. And clearly everybody knows this is insane, so we're just like crossing our fingers and pretending. Are they convincing themselves of this?
Doug, it's worse than that. It's worse than that. Now the powers that be within Europe are not even pretending anymore. I was filming a documentary for Channel 4 a few weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and I was in Frankfurt interviewing people in the financial markets, banks, the stock exchange, as part of that documentary. I spoke to eight, I counted them, financiers. They were chief economists of banks, they were chief analysts at the Frankfurt Stock Exchange. Only one of them spoke to me on camera. The rest, the remaining seven, said exactly the same things but refused to be on camera. All of them, as if singing from the same hymn book, had the following to say. They all agree with what you said, that this Greek bailout Mark II, just like Greek bailout Mark I, for that matter, is a great disaster. It's idiocy inaction. They know it's not going to succeed. And what they are telling me is that its function is to keep everything looking as if it's stable until the French presidential election is over and done with. Mrs. Merkel has invested a great deal in supporting Mr. Sarkozy. And the intention is that after that, sometime in June, July, countries like Greece and Portugal will be kicked out of the euro. They seem to think that they can amputate certain limbs, southern limbs of the eurozone, and cauterize those limbs, and save the rest of the eurozone, in particular save the monetary union between Germany with France, Italy, and Spain.
And they assume also then that Italy and Spain won't get sucked into the vortex.
They hope that Italy and Spain can be preserved as part of the eurozone, but they are not 100% certain that they will succeed in doing that. They have Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, who is printing money as if there is no tomorrow, providing it to the Italian, to the Spanish banks. This is why, if you notice, the interest rates paid by Italy and Spain to borrow money have come tumbling down. And that is because the Italian and Spanish banks have been stuffed with cash, freshly minted cash that came out of the European Central Bank. And the purpose of that is to shore up the Italian and Spanish debt, ring-fencing it effectively from the disaster that is about to befall Greece and Portugal, possibly Ireland as well.
Now, why should Greece not just default and leave the euro?
Well, this is the 2 trillion euro question. Look, it would have been fabulous had Greece never entered the euro in the first place. It is a disaster that Greece is in the euro. But getting out of the euro is not going to take us to where we would have been had we not entered it. It is going to throw us off a terrible, terrible, terrible cliff. And the reason is very simple. Greece is still an economy with high savings. Even though the Greek state has been profligate and has a large debt, the private sector of Greece, just normal households, as well as companies, have quite a lot of savings. All those savings are in euros. Since the crisis began, these savings have been taken out of banks, mostly Greek banks, and There are people that keep their savings in vaults, stuffed in their mattresses, but mostly in non-Greek banks, either in Switzerland, in London, or in Germany. Now, in a country where you have all those savings in euros, euro will become immediately a foreign currency the moment Greece gets out of the euro. You're going to have the bifurcation, a dichotomy, which is an awful dichotomy, between those who have savings in a foreign currency, and then the ATMs will be churning out the new drachma, let's say, and those will be the pensions and the public sector wages and the private sector wages. The moment the money comes out of the ATM, those who get it, they will try the new money, the Greek money, they will try immediately to swap it for the euros that are swimming around in the form of savings in Greece. This will mean that the new drachma is going to devalue exceptionally fast, and there will be two Greeces. Though the Greece that operates on the basis of the foreign currency that has been stocked up in the past, and the Greece of the flowing, constantly, exponentially devaluing Greek currency. It will resemble Turkey in the 1980s, when there were two Turkeys, the European Turkey that dealt in French francs and Deutschmark, even Greek drachmas, and the other that was a very eastern and depressed place where people simply struggled to live under third world conditions.
Now, people point to Argentina as a possible precedent for Greece. Argentina's default in the early 2000s. Why is that a valid precedent?
I don't think so. Argentina is a valid precedent. I wish we could, but it's not a valid precedent for two fundamental reasons. The first one is that Argentina had its own currency, which had a peg with the dollar, but nevertheless, it had its own currency. It was very simple, technically speaking, to simply sever that peg, to say, okay, well, from now on, it's not one peso, $1. When you have the euro, and the euro remains a legal tender elsewhere, as well as within Greece, simply saying that we're going to force you to give us your euros and exchange them for the new currency, well, firstly, this is unconstitutional. It means that Greece would have to be thrown out of the European Union altogether, because let's say that this were to happen, and my few hundred euros of savings in the bank were to be forcefully converted into the Greek drachmas, and I could take the Greek government to the European Court of Human Rights, and I would win. So you can imagine the tumult that would happen then. So that's one reason. We don't have a peg, we have a foreign currency. The second, unlike Argentina, the second great and grave difference with Argentina is that Argentina had a large export sector, which immediately after the default, it started generating masses of primary commodities, primarily, that China wanted to buy. And China played a significant role in soothing Argentina's path out of default and catastrophe. Greece doesn't have that. So there will be no benign path out of the great trauma of forcefully converting euros into drachmas.
Finally, let's look for the longer term. There's just really no way in the euro or out that Greece is going to avoid intense economic pain for some time. But what about the longer term? Is there a strategy for regenerating the Greek economy to generate some kind of stability and prosperity over a 5 or 10 or 20 year period?
Well, the answer is a very simple no. The powers that be, the elites in Greece, are desperately seeking to use whatever power and legitimacy they are left with in order to avert the official declaration of default, because they're in the pockets primarily of the bankers, of the Greek bankers, who do not want this to happen at any cost, because their banks are being kept alive by the European Central Bank, and their power base is precisely that bailout mode. So the Greek elites are utterly and completely consumed in maintaining this pretense at the expense of the productive fiber and the long-term future of the country. My hope is that, given that it is impossible to keep avoiding the inevitable forever, and that inevitable doesn't only apply to Greece, but it also applies to the rest of the Eurozone will find a way of pulling itself together and understanding that unless deficit countries like Greece, Portugal, Ireland, even Spain, can find a long-term path to growth, and there are such paths that can be found if we put our collective mind to it, then the whole of the Eurozone will be in jeopardy. Now, this is a hope that I entertained much more strongly about a year ago than I do today, and that's because I don't see any evidence of such intelligent life in the power corridors of Brussels, of Frankfurt, and of Berlin. But it has to be that hope. Otherwise, we're talking about a Hayekian kind of reality, a very bleak Herbert Hoover, Friedrich von Hayek world, in which everything is liquidated, and hopefully out of the pile of ashes that will remain, some green shoots will come out.
A Herbert Hoover Hayekian world, as in Friedrich von Hayek, the right-wing Austrian economist, of liquidation in the hope that some green shoots will rise from the ashes. A grim evaluation from Yanis Varoufakis, but probably right. Yanis Varoufakis is a professor of economics at the University of Athens. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this one more excerpt from the second movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 32, performed by Andras Schiff. Till next week, bye.